Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Two well-known people, designer Kate Spade and chef Anthony Bourdain, took their own lives last week. It's unfortunate, but often the topic of suicide gets more attention after a celebrity suicide death. And just as unfortunate, there has been a spike in suicide deaths after a celebrity takes their own life. The Centers for Disease Control reported last week that suicide rates increased in 49 states, some dramatically, between 1999 and 2016. During those years, Pennsylvania's suicide rate went up by more than 34%. Why? And what can be done about it? We have a panel today to talk about this very important topic. Govan Martin is chair of the board of directors of Prevent Suicide PA. Mr. Martin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for being here, Scott.
Also joining us is Perry Rosen. She's a school psychologist and project director of the Garrett Lee Smith Youth Suicide Prevention Grant. She's employed by the Office of Mental Health Substance Abuse Services under the Department of Human Services. Ms. Rosen, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Kelly Golick is executive director of Contact Helpline. Ms. Golick, we're glad to see you this morning.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Maybe there's experience you would like to relate. Maybe you have a question about someone you know. Maybe yourself. Maybe someone out there is experiencing some thoughts themselves. And if you would like to call in and ask about that, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. This isn't going to be a normal program in that we're going to provide some information, that some phone numbers you can call, some contact numbers that you can reach out to if you are in a crisis situation or you know someone who is. Actually, they are on our website, WITF.org. Govan Martin, when I reached out to you last week about doing this topic, you reminded me that the last time we spoke was in 2014. That was after comedian and actor Robin Williams died by suicide. We produced a program in 2016 on suicide, and here we are talking about it again after the suicide deaths of two celebrities. Now, first of all, I'm not happy with that at all, that every 2 years we have done a program on suicide. It's too important a topic to just talk about in a public forum every 2 years. But let's face it, one of the reasons that we're doing it is that there were two celebrities, two well-known people who died by suicide last week. Why does it take something like that for this nation to have that conversation?
Well, I think I really believe that suicide is still a taboo subject. It's still a stigmatizing word to say. As a society, I think we're definitely in the suicide realm. We're reactionary. We're not proactive into actually talking about suicide because it is sad, it is tragic. And also, you know, the words associated with suicide, that person must have been weak, that person must have been crazy, that person must have been selfish. And we need to change that philosophy because that's not the truth at all. And so I really believe that even in talking to you before the program started is that, you know, we would love to come in and do more of these programs to talk about suicide to make it less stigmatizing. That, you know, that a lot of people think about suicide. However, you know, not everybody who thinks about suicide actually attempts or dies by suicide. So again, it's, you know, it's having the discussion, being proactive. And, you know, really what I want to say here today, one of the things obviously is just to talk about it with our friends and family and to go home and say, hey, who would you turn to if you were in a crisis? Obviously, I think each one of us can go on and on and on, so I will let the other
one answer. I'm going to ask Perry Rosen, as a psychologist and a school psychologist, you see a lot of young people. Do the people that you see talk more about it after there's a tension like this?
Well, I think that certainly with any suicide, there's a risk of contagion. And a lot of that comes down to how we're talking about suicide and how this is being portrayed, especially in the media. In schools, whenever there's a suicide, we think about a postvention response, which is about minimizing a risk of contagion. And a lot of that is about identifying those youth that are at risk, at increased risk, really anybody that is vulnerable, whether they've been exposed to that suicide in some way or just have, you know, a mental health condition themselves or some other trauma. We try to identify those youth and, you know, screen them appropriately so that we can get them connected with the supports that they need.
Contagion. What, you know, we're going to talk about that with celebrity suicide deaths in particular, but I mean, is this something that happens even in a school setting?
Absolutely. Really, in schools, in any setting, and we do see this with celebrity deaths as well, where others could be at increased risk of suicidal behavior when we do have a suicide that happens, especially a high-profile suicide or a suicide in a specific context like a school setting where others are exposed.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk more about that. Kelly Golic, your organization, Contact Helpline, you speak... I don't know about you in particular, but your organization has conversations with people in crisis. And I don't want to focus on this contagion impact, but it kind of goes along the same lines of why it gets so much attention, why we speak about suicide a little bit more after the death of a well-known person. Do you see more calls? Do you hear from more people in crisis? Do you notice any difference whatsoever?
What we've noticed in particular recently with the most recent suicides is individuals calling in and actually talking about it, not necessarily expressing the fact that they themselves are suicidal, but trying to kind of understand and wrap their head around how somebody who seems to have it all then takes their life. And these are individuals who may struggle with mental health issues, may struggle with social isolation. And, you know, if somebody who has everything can't make life work, what does that mean for them? Not that they're in an active suicide state, but they need to process that through, and they are reaching out and calling and talking about that in particular.
Why would they call you and ask that question?
Well, Contact Helpline, we've been around for almost 50 years providing emotional listening support to the community. So one of the things that we do is create a safe place for anybody to call anonymously to talk about whatever they need to talk about. And suicide does happen to be one of the topics that individuals will call and talk about. And because it's safe, they can talk about it without fear of necessarily an intervention if they need to just process through their thoughts. But then there is options for intervention and warm transfers and getting support involved if that is the next step that they need. So it really does provide a nice safe place for somebody who's scared, afraid to talk to family and friends, to call and start to process through their thoughts and feelings.
Why won't people talk to family and friends about suicide?
They're afraid of the repercussions. You know, possibly, especially if it's to an employer, you know, they might feel that, or their fellow employees, oh my God, my boss is going to find out. They're going to fire me. They're going to lay me off. They're going to tell somebody else. If I tell family, what are they going to do? You know, there's that idea that if we talk about suicide to other people, that they are going to get that impression that they're crazy weak. And am I going to be put in a straitjacket? Am I going to be locked up somewhere mm-hmm. because of this so-called irrational thinking? And that's the furthest from the truth. I think we all have problems, and we all need to talk about them. However, suicide is still that taboo word that, you know, has been going on for centuries.
Mm. Any employer that would lay an employee off who's going through a crisis, you don't want to work for anyway, but still. I mean, the reality is that it may not be that they are thinking, okay, I don't want this person to work for me if they're considering suicide, but just what you said, that they're weak, that they, you know, that emotionally or mentally they're not fit to work for this company.
Well, I'm not saying that way for all.
I understand what you're saying.
I will say this for, you know, like one of the professions that possibly they really take it seriously. However, like law enforcement, and I, as a former state trooper that they don't, you know, especially all over the country, they do want people carrying guns who possibly are suicidal. So they'll put them on especially what is known as rubber gun squad. That's not here in Pennsylvania, but it is in other states that they'll put them on desk duty, which already has a stigma as it is. And then, you know, either they'll lay that person off or they'll say either get help and or you're going to be fired or we can't have someone like you on our job. Right. And there are other professions, unfortunately, that do that
yeah.
same thing.
Yeah, I can see that. Let's go to Ann in Quarryville. Ann, you're on the air. Hello, Ann. Okay, I guess Ann is no longer there, but I do have the question she was going to ask. She said she has a friend whose son may have died by suicide, obviously dead but not sure of the cause. She's not sure what to say to the friend. Can you suggest an approach to the topic? And this is, again, one of the reasons we don't talk about it, because when a tragedy has occurred, people don't know what to say.
Right.
How does he talk about it?
And, you know, that can be really a really difficult situation. And, you know, there are warning signs for suicide, but sometimes we don't always see those warning signs until it's too late. It's often easier to see those warning signs looking back, but we do a lot of education and training to hopefully help more people be able to identify those warning signs sooner. But, you know, I think a really important thing to reinforce to her friend is that, you know, that's not our fault, right? We can't be responsible for what we didn't know. And, you know, moving forward, when we do have that information, we can hopefully be aware of that to try to intervene if we do see somebody else that may be struggling.
But, Perry, you know how difficult this is. We as a society have difficulty talking about death, period. I mean, death of a child. I have heard from so many parents over the years have said that when people walk up to a parent who has lost a child, that people don't know what to say. So they avoid it.
Right.
Suicide is another one of those things that they just, and especially initially after the death, there may be some support, but then after a while, it kind of goes away. And just people are not comfortable talking about death, period, let alone death by suicide.
Absolutely. No, that's the case. And that's something, as Govan was mentioning earlier, that we need to be more comfortable talking about. And following up with individuals that have struggled, as well as family members that have lost a loved one to suicide, is so important. Losing someone to suicide is also a risk factor for suicide. And so being aware of that and just, you know, continuing to reach out and provide support is going to be so important.
Kelly, I was curious when we were talking about that that risk that Perry was just talking about. And I keep going back to you for trends or things that you have seen, experiences you've had. After when you have you heard from family members or friends of, you know, who have had a loved one, had a friend that died by suicide and then actually was thinking about it themselves?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the feelings in particular that we associate and we're very uncomfortable with is the sense of helplessness that comes with death and dying and suicide. We feel, as a society, we are problem solvers. Every problem has a solution to it. And suicide just doesn't feel like that's the right solution. How did we miss it? And now we're helpless. And with that helplessness comes guilt. And those are uncomfortable feelings that, as survivors, we carry around with us. So when our callers call in, we really are able to listen and hear the expression of those kinds of feelings and acknowledging that. So if I'm a friend or family member of somebody who I'm uncomfortable approaching, you know, just that sense of grief and helplessness that they now feel.
You know,
and acknowledging that.
Probably a good time. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, throughout the program, we want to make sure that we mention places and contacts that you can have that if there are people in crisis, people thinking about suicide, maybe someone you know. But Kelly, contact Helpline for Central Pennsylvania. Describe exactly what your organization does.
Well, we actually provide two services that are both helpline-based. One is our emotional listening support hotline, where we're 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Anybody can call us anonymously. We don't have caller ID through that and talk about whatever it is that they need to talk about. We are not counselors. You know, conversations are, you know, 10 to 15 minutes long, and we're there to get you through that moment of anxiety or frustration or fear or helplessness and support you through and identify your feelings during that very difficult time in your life. You can call us back as many times as you like, you know, over the course of time. We've had individuals over the years who will call us for 3 or 4 months during a grief time period. But once they've kind of worked through that initial real heavy grief, then they never call us again. But they might call us every day or every couple of days during that time period. But the other thing that we do is we are one of the providers of the PA-211 Health and Human Service Information Referral Hotline. So residents throughout Pennsylvania just need to dial 3 digits, just 211, again, 24 hours a day. And that's where you can find resources. So counseling, support groups, educational information, prevention programs. If you're looking for help, if you want somebody to come to your church or your school and you call 211 and ask for information, we can refer you to programs like the ones that are here today and other programs that might be in your community to help cope and deal with this.
211, that's very easy to remember. Mm-hmm. Again, on our website, WITF.org, we have the phone number, the 800 number for contact helpline. We also have the National Suicide Prevention Line on that website. So please go to it. If you know someone or you are in crisis, those are numbers that you can access. We'll talk more about this in just a moment. Take some phone calls. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about suicide prevention. A lot of topics related to suicide today. If you have a question or a comment or you know, you want some information, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can do the same on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today, Kelly Golic, who is Executive Director of Contact Helpline. Perry Rosen is a school psychologist and project manager of the Garrett Lee Smith Youth Suicide Prevention Grant. And Govan Martin, Chair of the Board of Directors of Prevent Suicide PA. 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Caroline, I believe, in York. Is it Caroline?
Carolina.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're named after the state. Which one?
I'm sorry?
I was going to say south or north, but go ahead. Sorry, I'm joking with you. Go ahead, Carolina.
Well, I was just going to say that every time people talk about suicide is after the fact, and one thing that I thought that needs to be mentioned is that insurance companies don't really allow you to have access to mental health care in the manner that a person might need. Some of them limit the amount of visits to a psychologist, or they limit the amount of medication that they are going to cover. Sometimes a psychiatrist will recommend a type of medication, and then the insurance company says that that particular one is not approved, that you have to use a different one. So I think one place to start is to somehow mandate that insurance companies provide adequate coverage for everybody. And if you allow me just one question to the school counselor, I believe that there, especially here in New York, I've found out that lots of the middle schools, from the middle school on, they don't have, like, actual recess, but it's long, and that allows them to just run around and do stuff. And how does she feel about the lack of longer recess for children and teenagers?
All right. Thank you very much for your call.
Well, I think certainly those downtimes during the day, that gives the opportunity for students to have that outlet and to also connect with their peers is so essential. I mean, you know, these days schools really can't just focus on academics anymore. We really have to focus on the whole child, and that includes the learning piece, but also the social, emotional, and behavioral wellness and the mental health piece as well. So, you know, recess is really part of that, and I can't speak to, you know, different school policies necessarily and how the schedule looks, but, you know, that is such an important part of the day for a lot of students.
Well, something else that just came to mind when Carolina asked that question is that One issue that many schools have is there just aren't enough counselors. Now, guidance counselors that most people think of related to academics, that's one thing. But a person in your position, a school psychologist, a counselor that actually deals with the emotional or mental issues that some students are dealing with, that many schools don't have those because of a lack of money.
I'm really, really glad you brought that up, actually. And I think that's a huge barrier to us being able to more effectively provide these supports and services to students in schools. School psychologists and school counselors and school social workers are all mental health professionals based in the schools that are qualified to provide these supports and trained to really implement a range of programming for students to provide a continuum. But unfortunately, because of our ratios, we really do get restricted to certain roles, school counselors as guidance counselors, school psychologists more as evaluators, when really we're trained to do crisis response, we're trained to do prevention, we're trained to offer mental health supports and services. So that is a really big piece of the puzzle that needs addressing in this work to more effectively support students in schools.
Let's take a call from Cynthia in York. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just want to make a comment with the, you know, the stereotype you had even mentioned with people thinking people that do it, they're crazy or weak. I just want to put that out there that I had two family members commit suicide in their 50s. And both of them were extremely, extremely strong people. I mean, if you can think, if anybody out there can think of the most strongest and good employment and tight family, and that happens to them, it's mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling. We don't have, neither one left notes. We have no idea why they did it. Totally unexpected, but people should understand. We saw not even any signs. So if you can mention some kinds of signs, totally out of the blue. We're just, and one was just a year ago.
Well, Cynthia,
mind-boggled through the whole thing.
Cynthia, my heart goes out to you and your family. That's tough to hear.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling in and experience and sharing your experience. But the point she makes is a real good one. And the three of you kind of touched on this, that everyone kind of thinks that, oh, these signs are so obvious that, of course, maybe you realize them later, but again, the stereotype of someone who's weak, who's having emotional or mental issues. And, Govan, I bring that up because you had a family member who died by suicide.
Yeah, actually, my brother died. He was only 16, and that was 38 years ago, and I was 17, and unfortunately, he died by suicide. And, you know, why I mentioned the length was that in some ways, we really haven't come a long way in having that discussion about suicide, and I'm so glad that you invited us here today, because, you know, and hopefully we'll have more in the upcoming, you know, months and years, but it is sad when... You know, I felt that there was no one to talk to. That, you know, when I went back to school and my friends and my family didn't even discuss it. And, you know, my friends would sort of just kind of dance around, just like, I'm sorry, but that was it. That was the end of the discussion. And even up to, you know, just recently, if you tell people, you know, who ask you, well, did you have, you know, grow up with any brothers or sisters? And I said, well, I had a brother. And they would go, wow, what happened? Well, he died. And oh, how did he die? By suicide. And then there's a silence. And there's a shock look. And then they'll say, oh. And boy, talk about a conversation ender, unfortunately. And, you know, for years, I really didn't discuss suicide at all. So luckily, I met somebody who was what we call survivors of loss, who was also in the mental health field. And she had what turned out to be I thought was going to be a 5-minute discussion, ended up being a 2-hour conversation in the parking lot about how her loss affected her and how loss affected me. So that's really what got me into this field and why I'm sitting here today.
So 38 years later, I mean, obviously, I'm just sitting here watching you. It's still a very painful topic. And I also find myself saying, okay, I feel sorry. I want to express my sympathies. But even I'm struggling with that.
Well, I think, you know what? That's, even if you just said that, and I would have appreciated that all those years ago, and I appreciate it now. So thank you. But that's all, you know, it's just being able to talk about it. That's why contact is so important, that they can call up and actually talk about their situation and not feel that someone's going to be judgmental or someone's going to be non-accepting of what happened to, you know, the situation. So again, and we still have to mention the word suicide. It should not be a conversation ender. It should have been like, I would have cherished the fact that, well, tell me what was going on. Did you see any signs? You know, I am so sorry for how that happened to you. What is it doing to you right now? And so it's just having that conversation. And so hopefully, again, hopefully being proactive and having the conversation prior to a suicide instead of, you know, after a suicide, that will make the difference.
We have an email along the same lines. Says, a friend of my family died by suicide about 3 years ago. The person was my brother's best friend, and it affected him significantly and still does. The person's suicide name comes up in conversation at times, and my children ask who that is. I explain it was a friend of the family that died. I normally say he was so sad he felt like there were no solutions to him being sad. So if you ever feel like that, be sure to call me or someone else, and someone will help you. My children don't like it when we talk about dead people in general. My family thinks I'm annoying, but mental health problems run in my family, and I try to talk about them so that if something happens, my children are prepared, just like they know what to do if their nose runs. I feel like it's a good opportunity to discuss the issue with my kids. Can you give me any good way to explain suicide to them?
I mean, honestly, and just hearing what she's already said, I think that's exactly the way to go about it. You know, that we avoid the topic and that we dance around it is not going to help anything. And especially if mental health problems run in the family, suicides run in the family, it is something so important to start to talk to kids about early on. And just as she's saying, equating it with a physical health problem is, you know, a completely valid and appropriate way to go about that. I think that normalizes it too, and it makes it so that it isn't something that's so heavily stigmatized, and it just opens up the door to think about it just as we would any other health problem that we would be experiencing. So I think she's doing a great job with that.
You said suicides run in families?
Yeah, this is something we know, that a suicide in a family is a significant risk factor for another suicide to occur, and it's not causal, right? So just because there's a suicide in a family doesn't necessarily mean that there will be another one, but we know that to be a significant risk factor, and so especially when that is the case, having open conversations like what this person who emailed is describing is going to be important. And again, as Govan's been talking about, being proactive with, you know, let's talk about this. What are the resources? Will you come to me if you're having trouble? And I'm going to come to you. And even if it's perceived as being annoying, you know, that's something that's just important to continue on with that conversation.
One of the most important aspects, as I see, of this program today is talk about signs that people can observe. What are some of the signs of someone thinking about suicide?
So there are many different signs, and sometimes they can differ a little bit between youth and adults, but we know that talking about suicide, whether it's through some sort of direct statement, you know, I'm thinking about killing myself, or some sort of indirect statement, you know, I'm tired of life, I just can't go on, even writing about suicide, or in younger children, sometimes drawing in pictures, images of death, and searching online as well about the topic of suicide or ways to die by suicide.
There's, obviously increased alcohol or drug use, preoccupation with death. You know, really a dramatic change in personality if you see it. You know, it never hurts to ask or just to, you know, bring up, hey, you know, you don't seem right today. You seem different. What's going on with you? And that might lead to a more serious conversation to say, you know, I'm really worried about you, you know, and some people in your situation, you know, often think about taking their own life. I wonder if you're thinking about suicide. And I think if you open it up in that conversation, there's, you know, the reaction usually, we hope, is a positive reaction. And really, there isn't really a lot of negative. No one goes, they get so angry at you that they're going to withdraw. But most people who are asked a direct question, just like I said, are you thinking about suicide, will give you a direct answer. And usually, if they are, they're going to say, yeah, I have been thinking about it. Or they'll give you a visible reaction or an emotional reaction where you can then, you know, press on and go, wow, I see how that question really affected you. And it is being calm in the sense of, you know, not reacting, oh my God, don't think about that. It's like, it's, you want to show that you care for the individual, as I'm sure, you know, Perry and Contact does. They're, you know, we have to react in a positive way, that you want to thank them for being honest with you and for telling you, and not getting emotional yourself about, maybe you can get emotional on the inside, but once you remain calm on the outside and making sure that they know that they feel loved, they feel cared about, that they're not alone, which people who are often thinking about suicide often feel.
Kelly, is it true that someone who has made the decision to call Contact Helpline has actually taken a first step because they realize that they're in crisis, or that they need some help, or they just want to talk to someone? But, you know, probably, I don't know, I'm not going to judge and say it's maybe better to have this conversation with family and friends, but if you need just someone to talk to, is it a big step to make that phone call to you?
It absolutely can be for individuals. One of the risk factors, I think, that we particularly see and witness regularly on our helpline is this sense of isolation and disconnection. So some of the things that I've heard my colleagues here talking about is about connection, asking the question, you know, not being afraid to talk to somebody about suicide. And a lot of times individuals that are calling us, they're looking for that connection. They want somebody to care.
It's a call for help.
And they want somebody to hear that they're having some kind of difficulty. So that's our goal. Our goal is to hear and provide that emotional connection, where, and so many times, you can be surrounded by a group of people and feel like you're the loneliest person in the whole wide world. And when you call Contact, we hope that we can alleviate some of that sense of loneliness, that there is somebody there that's willing to listen, give you a few minutes of time, and truly hear you. So many times, I've talked to individuals who, I always think of one particular suicide call that I took many, many years ago. And during the conversation, the woman was telling me her life story. And she had a very wonderful life, but had decided that it was time. And I, you know, we do active listening. We focus a lot on feelings. And she just burst into tears. And she said to me, all these years, I never thought somebody could understand what I felt. And she had years of counseling. She had been married. She had adult children. And it wasn't until that conversation with a complete stranger that she felt like somebody listened to her. And then she said to me, I wish my husband would listen to me the way you have tonight. So listening and giving people that opportunity to share what's going on, their deepest, darkest hurts and pains, matters. And sometimes that's all it takes. And they're, you know, they don't need that next step. They don't need an intervention. But then there's those other people who need a warm handoff to crisis or need a referral to a community program. So I really do believe that people who are in pain, if they reach out, somebody will listen.
And that's what we're going to talk about next. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Govan Martin, chair of the board of directors of Prevent Suicide PA. Perry Rosen is a school psychologist and project director of the Garrett Lee Smith Youth Suicide Prevention Grant. And Kelly Golick is executive director of Contact Helpline. We're talking about suicide. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. staff. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And before we get back into our conversation, just another reminder, if you are in need of help, you're looking for resources, call 211 here in Pennsylvania. Go to WITF.org. We have a list of the contact helpline, the phone number, also the national crisis line for those who are considering harming themselves or taking their own life. All those numbers are there. All that information is at our website, WITF.org, under Smart Talk. So go there if you are in need of some assistance. Let's go to Bill in York. Bill, you're on the air.
Okay. I want to know if there is a percentage of suicides that everyone has that it deal with people who are going through a divorce or a case when a large employer in a town closes up shop and leaves town. Mm-hmm. I live in a town like that in Western Pennsylvania, and when the steel mills shut down, it seemed like the suicide rate went up.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you very much for your call. And I'm just going to expand on Bill's question because he has hit on something that I understand that most of the time it is not just one event that leads to a suicide. And it is not that someone is necessarily mentally ill, has a mental illness, but there could be a series of events just like he described, the loss of a job, the loss of a relationship, lost of a loved one, just things not going well in life, that all these things can contribute, correct?
You're yes. Absolutely correct, yeah. I think we all agree on that one.
Yeah.
I think, but you hit the key word there, loss. Loss is, for anything, can affect people greatly. And Bill is correct, you know, as far as, you know, divorces do have an effect on people. Relationship problems, loss of it. Intimate type of relationship or any relationship, especially to suicide, financial setbacks, substance abuse, physical health problems, feeling like you're a burden to others. But one of the major issues, just like Bill said and you said, Scott, is loss. And I think that will have an effect on anybody. I mean, but some people, it's never just one issue, though. Suicide is always multi-causal. So along with the loss factor, it could be any one of the things I just mentioned, but also, you know, somebody suffering from depression, somebody suffering from some type of mental illness, which adds to that, somebody possibly using more alcohol or drugs. And it could be a lot of different things, actually. But, you know, the more problems we have, you know, which makes it a higher risk of possibly thinking about suicide.
Something else that Bill reminded me of is that when you look at the research, that the group, that the demographic, if you will, that is most at risk is white men, and usually in middle age. And he was talking about friends lost their jobs at the factory or at a mill and had taken their own lives. So, you know, that's probably not the stereotype that many people think of, but it is white men in middle age, for the most part, who are most at risk. Now, that's not to say it doesn't happen in any other age group, because we know it does. Before, I think, again, one of the most important parts of this program is providing some information to those out there that may be in crisis or may need some help. What would you recommend?
So in addition to Contact, which we've heard about a lot today, there are some other national resources, and you've actually mentioned one in particular, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. So every county in Pennsylvania has a crisis number and contact locally in the county. And at our Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, we're working really hard to increase the number of call centers in the counties that affiliate with the National Lifeline and are equipped to take calls from the National Lifeline. So that's a big effort right now in Pennsylvania. The other is Crisis Text Line, which is actually a texting service with trained crisis counselors. Again, similar to the Lifeline, it's free, it's confidential, it's 24/7. And we know that about 75% of users to the text line line are youth, because that, you know, seems to be the preferred modality these days. And, you know, we certainly want to promote all of these. We think it's better to have a conversation with a person. But if someone's inclined to text when they wouldn't otherwise mm-hmm. pick up the phone to call, then we definitely want to promote that resource as well. And that number is 741-741.
I'm glad you gave when you gave the number for that correspond with TALK, because if you know if I'm in a crisis situation, I don't want to figure out what the numbers are.
Right.
You know,
yeah. And we think that everybody should put those in their phone right now. I mean, you never know when you're going to need those numbers for yourself, for anyone you're interacting with. So, you know, have them in your phone, and they're there if you need them.
And if you have a smartphone, you can put them as apps too. If you're in crisis, there's a lot of actually apps that will help. But Scott, I want to bring up something real quick. Carolina said earlier about people who sometimes you can't afford.
Yes. Yeah, we didn't really talk about insurance. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, and doing research for your program, you know, I found some really good resources for people to reach out to. One is Open Path Collective, and if you go to openpathcollective.org, it's a collection of U.S. therapists who offer lower rates. So it doesn't eliminate the cost totally, but there are a lot lower rates that you can go to and have talk to a licensed therapist. Also, you can go to CatholicCharities.org, which provides outpatient mental health services to chapters across the country. Actually, there's one in Harrisburg. Mm-hmm. And actually, a lot of people don't know this, but Medicare covers psychotherapy services for everybody on Medicare, and it covers about 80% of the cost, which is significant cost, you know, for an average of possibly someone who might be $150 to $200, you might only pay, you know, $25 for a visit. And also there's one more website I want to mention is betterhelp.com. It's the world's largest online counseling platform that offers help to anyone with an internet connection and talk to licensed professional therapists. So there are some great resources if you can't necessarily, you know, afford to go to a full-priced therapist, if you don't have insurance, that you can go to some of those resources, and I can give you, maybe you can put them on your website.
Okay. I want to follow up on that. You know, we talked about there's a shortage of counselors in schools. There seems to be a shortage of mental health professionals out there too, or at least access to mental health, whether there are people who are not going in because their insurance plans don't cover it, they're afraid of the of how much money would cost them. But is that an issue as well, that we just don't have enough people to talk to who are professional mental health professionals, I should say?
Well, you know, that tends to be a more significant issue within the rural areas.
Yeah.
And we actually know from our data that suicide rates are higher in rural areas. There's just more isolation in general, less of this access to mental health professionals. So, you know, there is a movement in the field toward more telepsychology, you know, kind of remote options for people. But again, there are barriers as well with, you know, internet connections and things like that. That's definitely something that still, you know, needs to be worked out, but is, you know, kind of really growing, I think, because of some of these access issues.
You know, I started the program talking about the CDC coming out last week and talking about the increase, and those are significant increases in states across the country. Every state except Nevada, for some reason, had an increased suicide rate. Do we know why? I mean, and by the way, that was from 1999 to 2016,
right,
that where they did the research. Any idea why? Any theories on why?
So from experts in the field, there's really no clear explanation to that. And a lot of that comes down to what we've talked about with suicide just being such a complex behavior. You know, a lot of the increases that we've seen really started around the mid-2000s, even within that time frame. And so, you know, some have speculated about just some of the social changes, some of the economic changes, housing instability. We know kind of with the rise of technology and just our constant access to our devices that, you know, we're always on, and we don't necessarily, we're accessible 24 hours a day, and it really impacts our ability for self-care. And so there's a lot of explanations, you know, looking at those kinds of issues. But then we also know that there are it has been a change with regard to more accurate reporting around, you know, actually determining that a death is a suicide. And because of stigma, because of a lot of issues like that, you know, things like single car motor vehicle accidents or, you know, accidental overdoses could be suicides. And more traditionally, we're not ruled suicides. And again, coming down to family stigma and different things like that. It also used to be the case that in Pennsylvania, coroners required there to be a suicide note to rule a death a suicide. Hmm. And we know that only in about 25% of suicides, somebody leaves behind a note. And that has changed in recent years. So, you know, there that can also, I think, be a factor in thinking about increasing rates as maybe more accurate identification of when a death is actually a suicide.
I didn't want to leave without mentioning the language that we use around suicide. I've gotten a few emails, and this is not a criticism because this is how most people refer to suicide. They've said committed suicide. And I've made the efforts because I was told about this years ago that we try not to use that kind of language, committed suicide, that death by suicide. Why? Why is language important?
Well, I really believe that actually language is important because, you know, using the word commit, usually commit connotates either a crime or a sin. So, and also it leaves a almost like a bad taste in someone's mouth. When for the survivors who die by suicide. So we've tried to change that to died by suicide or taken their own life instead of the word commit. But again, I think if we change a little bit of those dynamics, then we'll change how people think about suicide.
I think something else that Gary even mentioned, he was talking about, you know, methods. We in the media have been advised, do not mention the method of suicide, that a lot of times that ends up being a contagion as well, that, you know, you don't want to say that, you know, that someone used a firearm or, you know, as he described, and I understand how people do that, but that we in the media play a great role in this. We're out of time. Very important conversation, and I will make a promise that we will have this conversation more often in the future. But I want to thank the three of you, and also again remind our audience that if you're in need of some help and or know someone who is, go to our website wytf.org. There are a lot of issues there. Perry Rosen, the school psychologist, Govan Martin, chair of the board of directors, Prevent Suicide PA, Kelly Golic, executive director of Contact Helpline. Thank you very much. I hope we help some people today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, a little happier topic, but it's a Smart Talk road trip. We go to Harley-Davidson in York, so I look forward to talking to you.